for the start of the next week, and then we'll have another round of monsoonal moisture by the end of next week.
Okay. Hey, have a great weekend.
You
Thanks,
as well.
Adam.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:07.
The KPCW Weather Report is brought to you by Albion Financial Group.
Hi, this is Janelle Jacobson, and I am a proud supporter of KPCW programming. Ski Resort Property Group is a real estate team who are part of the Berkshire Hathaway Home Services. We have been pairing real estate buyers and sellers successfully for over 20 years. Learn more about us at skiresortproperty.com.
KPCW News Time now, 8:08. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. In the studio with me now from the Mountain Trails Foundation, Charlie Sturgis. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So going to be kind of rained out this weekend. Things could be a little tacky tomorrow, I'm guessing. But
yeah, we could have that, you know, summertime powder day thing going on out there another day or so. You know, and then things did dry out pretty fast after even that Monday storm. You know, just a few puddles were left behind and on Tuesday. And so given the conditions, I think be patient and all good things will come to pass, right? So anyways, let's see what's going on. You know, I was just taking a look. I got a little quick blip from one of the highway department's areas that, you know, we're going to have a closure on 224 from Marsac Roundabout all the way up to the Montage starting Monday. It's going to be intermittent at times. It's going to be fully closed at some point. So if you're a road cyclist or even a mountain biker that maybe uses that to connect some trails, I think you want to be super aware. And, of course, if you're trying to get up to the Scott's Bypass or something, it's going to be a big deal. So you definitely want to account for it, plan on it, and it's going to be a long project, it sounds like.
Yeah, paving, so, I think, all the way up. As
the
you
paving
mentioned.
All the way up. You know, at the end of the day, like so many projects that can be painful, we see a few of them ourselves. Basically, you're hoping that, you know, the finished product is going to be way better, and that's what you want. So keep that in mind. We do have an event out on in Round Valley Saturday morning. So this is the Renew Events 15K race. You know, 300 or 400 people show up for that event. It doesn't have any trail closures associated with it, but it does put a few extra people out there than you might normally see. The event will usually last about 3 hours, and it should be come and go pretty easily. It's not really as intense as a bike race out there, so it should be pretty cash. And, of course, if you're out there, cheer them on. The word from up in the ski areas this morning was there's nothing going on in terms of trail work. There won't be any closures. If you have been up on Dawns recently, where the gas line did go up through there, it's going to be a little bit. They're not when they get finished up in that those areas. We'll probably go back in and touch up Dawns Trail. Got a little bit, I would say, stomped on by some big equipment, which is fine. I mean, I rode it the other day. You could ride across it, but it's probably needs a little work. It's only 100 feet of it, maybe. So it's not a good reason to stay away. Just be be aware of it. What else is going on? I don't know.
You said you spent a couple days at Outdoor Retailers. What were you sitting there for?
You know, mostly connecting with our sponsors. Mm-hmm. You know, once again, our events are a major part of our fundraising. And we just finished up the Steeplechase, which all of our events, the next four, Park City Half Marathon is coming up on the 15th with the 5K, which is a kind of a new way of doing the event. And, of course, we have Mid-Mountain Marathon and Tour de Suds coming up in September. You know, we are really well supported by the outdoor industry. It makes a big difference having sponsors, having their products there, having them participate just keeps it exciting. So, it's really good to go down there and touch base. And we also try to find a few more new sponsors that are relevant to the Mountain Trails mission. So we're not just looking for anybody all the time, but we are a little choosy. So
were they showing off next summer's equipment?
Yeah, basically most of it is next summer's equipment. So, yeah, stuff that's coming down the line. So always exciting. Like I have a little cam envy at the moment because Black Diamond reduced the weight of their cams by half, which is pretty incredible because it's like 5 years ago they reduced it by 28 to 30%. And you can have 20 pounds of cams on you when you're climbing. So to reduce it by 10 pounds would be a big deal. And then I want to give a little shout out quickly just to a couple of the folks we were giving a little shout out to, the Jupiter Peak Steeplechase, which was the 20th running, and which Dave Hanscom had the records to remind me. But also Dave Hanscom showed up as the oldest runner, oldest male, number one, and oldest runner at 74. He ran it the very first year it was done. He ran it in 2 hours and 30 minutes, and this time he was just under 4 hours. He and Tom Miller, who's 73, both those guys have put on a lot of events in the area. So a little shout out to those guys. And Wendy Van Camp, also 67, ran it. So we were really super psyched to see, you know, don't let the age thing slow you down, right? Yeah. So.
So you took out IMBA on a tour earlier this week?
We did an IMBA tour, which is IMBA and a bunch of kind of VIPs that are here for the show. There was the new head of Outdoor Recreation for Colorado, which he's only been in the job about a month. Brad Peterson joined us. Andy Bierman could not at the last moment, which is unfortunate, but he's a heck of a rider, so it's always good to have him along. And, you know, we did what I think is a really pretty cool way to ride, which is basically we got on at the canyons, took one lift, and we rode over to Park City and basically descended to the base and then took Crescent. And then what was really exciting, and this was kind of a tour of some of the projects we had been doing, but what's really exciting at the end, we did ride up, get over to Deer Valley and got on in Sterling. And Steve Graff gave us a guided tour of some of the new Gravity Logic stuff that they've done. And, you know, I have to say that I'm not normally one who would pay for lift-assisted stuff, but if you really want to spend $27 and go have a lot of fun, their new gravity assist stuff is pretty darn cool. So if you haven't done a lot of it, it's a pretty good rush. And, yeah, there's no uphill traffic on it either. So and nobody walking. So anyhow, it is great fun, and congratulations to those guys for, you know, taking a new lead on that kind of activity around here. It's really cool.
Okay, Charlie, see you next week.
Hey, Leslie, have a good weekend.
It's Charlie Sturgis with Mountain Trails Foundation. It's 8:16 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, the Park City Board of Education spent the last 2 days in a retreat in the studio with some of the highlights. I have District Business Administrator Todd Hauber, as well as school board members Tanya Knauer and Phil Kaplan. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Phil, of course, the most important news, you were sworn into office after spending two beautiful days indoors. Any regrets?
I only regret sitting that long for 2 days. I like to be in motion. We're typical Park City people.
Yeah, yeah. So Wednesday you spent time talking about the master plan, the bond, the board schedule, of course, to discuss that in more detail on Tuesday, and then vote on a bond on August 18th. Sounds like there is a unified decision not to follow the Master Planning Committee recommendation and go ahead and move Dozier Field?
Well, let me go back a little bit. In terms of not following the Master Planning Committee suggestions, I'm not sure that's really quite accurate. 80% of what we're looking at is exactly what the Master Planning Committee has been talking about for 6 months, which is basically demolishing Treasure Mountain, building a 5-6 at the Ecker campus, and remodeling the high school. I think, you know, there's some outstanding areas that we still need to discuss. I mean, we took a straw poll, but that certainly we still have a week or two to change our minds. And we're obviously looking at, do we go south or west with the high school, which impacts what we do to Dozier. And that's really kind of a small piece of it. I mean, it seems like a big piece, but when you look at financially and academically what we're doing, it's really a pretty small piece.
Yeah. So in terms of costs, let's talk a little bit about that. We're hearing that it's really a wash to keep it where it is, or to move it even though we put $2 million into it a couple of years ago?
I think that's what we're trying to sift through right now. The numbers that we were given show that moving Dozier costs more, but you know how numbers can be. I mean, if you start building locker rooms in three different places, so there's a lot we need to look at, and I think we're trying to sift through those numbers right now. Am I correct, guys?
Yep.
So for those who don't want to see Dozier moved, why do you two think that that's the best decision?
We thought that generally, the board felt, and I'll articulate my own opinion, but felt that it was the most common sense plan to build the high school going west for the following reasons. That one, it just made more sense architecturally and academically in terms of the flow of students through the building, which is academics being the board's number one concern. Secondly, it allows for the future, since, you know, this board has to be a steward for whoever takes over, you know, 10 or 20 years from now. And thirdly, it did allow us to create an athletic area on the campus that makes a lot more sense. And then we believe, as you know, we're sure we'll be getting into traffic here at some point, that it makes more sense from a traffic perspective.
All right. And for you, Tanya?
Really almost the same things. I was kind of concerned when I saw those really long hallways as in this, the picture from the south. It just smelled like Treasure Mountain to me. And if you've been at Treasure Mountain with that U shape and the students changing, there's the flow of traffic is terrible. I mean, that's one of the reasons that Treasure Mountain needs to go. It's just it doesn't accommodate students changing class very well.
Yeah. So I think there was a little reluctance, at least what we heard from Roy Murphy as part of the Master Planning Committee, that some concern that if Dozier is part of the plan to get moved, that you may risk losing a bond election. But really, the only people who are going to be unhappy about it are a couple dozen, right, from Prospector and Park Meadows. I mean, you've got a big portion of voters out in the Snyderville Basin.
That's correct. And, you know, it's hard to say at this point. I mean, we haven't done a huge survey from the whole area. The other thing I just want to say about the Master Planning Committee, there wasn't exactly a vote taken on that plan, and there were a lot of different opinions about what was the best plan, which I think at some point was why the data was and the huge packet of information was tossed over to the board to start really deciphering through that and potentially putting the pieces together and what makes sense.
I'll just add, and you know, obviously I've only been on the board for about 6 weeks of what's been about a year process, but just even in the 6 weeks, I have seen people on every side of every possible decision. So at the end of the day, that's why you elect a school board, is to be able to make those kinds of tough decisions, and we will do it through the lens of what is right for our kids.
Yeah. What we haven't heard about are the results of the survey that I believe the district did conduct. I've heard from a handful of people. What did people have to say about moving Dozier Field? Do we have those results?
So that wasn't one of the specific questions of the survey itself. It was
Todd Haber, I should say.
Yes, thank you. The survey question that gets close to that was more the level of the bonding amount that the public would accept. And the Dozier Field sports complex was part of a composite question, if you will. And that question had a fairly high bond amount on it, and so there was not a favorable response to a very high bond amount. Now, whether that translates into don't move Dozier, I couldn't say.
So let's talk a little bit about, I mean, where you kind of lost people. So the top end, I hear, was $100 million for a bond, and people, the survey results said no?
Yeah, so the not support or somewhat not support, I think, was the two categories. It was in the 60% range.
So are those survey results available to the public?
They are. They're now out on the board's website, so you can go out onto board docs and pull up that survey. What's out there right now is the preliminary report, so it's kind of the raw data. It's how many people said what percentage response. On Tuesday, August 11th, we'll have the full report from Lighthouse Research.
So where did you see support for, given that this is statistically accurate?
Well, so, go ahead. Todd's the one who's really been sifted through those, so he should give the bond results. But it was very interesting.
Yeah, so there was a tiered question. There was a question, would you support projects in the $50 million range? And that was there was actually about a 70% positive response to that. But then the question was, if you didn't support 50%, would you support a 40%? And that came in a little over, now I can't remember, I want to say it's in the low 60s. And then it says if you couldn't support it at 40, would you support it at 30? And that came in about the same in that low 60% range. So we have kind of a feel of where an acceptable level might be.
So if we're at that $50 million level plus the $20 million that we have in the bank, that we're at $70 million, how far does that get us?
Well, you know, we're going to get some recommendations from the bond committee. I don't think we're going to spend the full 20. I mean, we feel like we need to save some of that for capital emergencies or projects. So, I mean, that's what the bond committee is going to be tasked with, is sort of coming up with an amount and some recommendations on term and all that other stuff, and giving us some per household, per year, or per month, or whatever prices. But we wanted to get a gauge of what the community is willing to accept. Because if we were to build everything we wanted to build, I mean, we could just keep going, right, and have $150 million. But that's not realistic. So really we're using some of the bond survey to kind of guide us on what makes sense. And then we're going to be looking at our list and piecing it together on what we feel like is the most important to accomplish and a dollar amount we feel that the public would be okay with.
So is this fair to say, Todd, I mean, just for easy numbers, that on a, say, a $500,000 home, it's going to be $100 more a year in your taxes?
Again, it depends on how much we bring in from the capital fund itself, because we can affect how much we buy and then what that impact is on the taxpayer. So we haven't boiled that number down. It's really more fair to say, well, what is the survey telling us and what are the projects that fit within that? And then we can give a real definitive answer of what that impact is on an individual.
Yeah. And I've heard recently it's like, well, we have not bonded, I think, at 1999. Is that?
Yes.
But people do need to realize that we've had two tax increases on our property taxes in the last 5 years, right?
Correct.
So we have been supporting education.
And very much so, and it's been to great effect within the school district. Yeah. And so we're very grateful for that.
So have we included the field house in any of these bond numbers? I mean, when we talk about $50 million, does a field house get built?
At $50 million, and assuming that you spent, you know, maybe 10 out of the capital account, you would not be able to build a field house. So you'd really have to be at a, you know, $70 million plus total ticket price, or around 70, depending on what else you'd finally accepted to build a field house. So that's one of the big things that has not been decided, and that frankly the board will decide on the August 11th board meeting. And I'll just add on the topic of the bond itself, the taxpayer impact is a direct product of the total ticket price. So the process is decide the ticket price, and then we will have a really clear number for taxpayer impact.
Yeah. You had heard from Athletic Director Jamie Sheets talking about, well, he thought it would be more important to have turf fields. Have those been included as opposed to a field house in the master plan?
I would say that Coach Sheets was expressing to the board alternatives. So I believe, and again, I'm speaking for myself, but I believe there is commitment on the board for upgrading our athletic facilities for Park City, which is a sports city. We have championship teams, and we have quite a few kids that participate to high impact on their lives in our sports. So we want to upgrade our athletic facilities, and whether that takes the form of building a field house or as an alternative, whether that takes the impact of turfing out a number of fields that can be used throughout the winter, we have to decide on also on Tuesday.
Yeah. And we're also talking about spending $3 to $4 million to add on to McPullen. Again, is this part of what we're talking about? Or is that, again, you know, kind of out there with the field house?
Well, it came in as one of the top priorities. And I think as we're looking at the capacity numbers in the elementary school, we're starting to say, well, maybe this isn't a top priority right now. But we also don't want to be caught in 5 years and not have a plan for if we do end up at capacity with our schools again. So it's kind of my guess is, and I'm just speaking for myself, I'd like to leave it there as a placeholder, but I'd like to make sure that we don't build too much capacity in our schools. And if we're pulling our fifth graders out, we're giving ourselves some space.
Yeah, I had heard that we're added on to McPullen as a way to offer students who don't want to be part of the full school dual immersion program. Wouldn't it be cheaper just to kind of move those students?
So it's my understanding that by moving things around a little bit at McPullen, we can probably do that anyway. And so I think we're having a principal changeover right now. Bob Edmiston, who was the McPullen principal, is going back there. And I think he and Greg Proffitt are talking about, you know, different scenarios. And I think they're going to put some ideas together for the superintendent. But, you know, it's really kind of an operational thing. But I don't know that we need to just build classrooms on to accommodate that right now.
Yeah. You know, and we've heard a lot about the reason we're doing all of this, and it was concern. It comes back to educating our kids and the concern of trying to lower the achievement gap. So some are questioning, what do buildings have to do with educational achievement? I mean, do either the board members?
I have a huge opinion on that. we're driven by a learning plan, which was put together by the superintendent, that has the goals of closing the achievement gap as well as staying high with our high students, basically keeping where we're at or even improving on that. And facilities need to mirror what you're doing with a learning plan. So, for example, if we're trying to close the achievement gap, and one of the methods to do that that we're bringing in is all-day kindergarten, then we need to have more space. So once you make determinations on where you want to go academically, you often have to follow that with some sort of facilities plan.
All right.
Is that right?
Do you want to add to that, Philip?
Yeah, I'll say that, I agree with what Tanya said. The all-day kindergarten, the grade realignment, were each done for the purposes of delivering the best academic product. And the facilities plan price tag is heavily being driven by our capacity needs, which reflect both the growth of the student population and the academic priorities.
Now, you spent, I think, most of the day yesterday looking at a lot of the testing data. So what was the take-home message with that? Is that not the case?
Well, I think that it's hard to really pinpoint that because the SAGE is a brand new test, and we don't really have trend data to look at yet. So it's really a matter of getting the administrative team, and the board was there to kind of just listen along and try to understand it, to understand where we're going in terms of using this data to set goals and also putting together a way to train our teachers to understand what this data means and to be able to communicate to our parents what this data means. So I think it's really we're trying to roll this out. So I wouldn't say we came back with like, oh, yeah, these numbers told us this, this, and this. It's really more of an evolution of learning how to use this tool.
It also was to set a baseline. So this was the first year that we have the data. So we have a mark to begin with, and we can then measure progress from there.
Yeah. But I guess the question is, if we're pouring up to $70 million in new construction and it does not lower the achievement gap, which is this is all about, then what?
Well, plans need to be revisited every year. And we have an assessment tool now that is hopefully giving us beginning of year, middle of year, and end of year data. So we're not just going to be taking an assessment or an autopsy, as I like to call it, at the end of the year. We're going to be evaluating what we're doing with our teaching at the beginning of the year to set the standards of what we need to do. In the middle of the year, are we hitting those marks? Where do we need to adjust our teaching? And then at the end of the year. So I think it's anytime you make a plan, you're just going to have to revisit it and say, this isn't working. We're going to need to change how we're doing this. And, we redid the reading program this year because the pullout program wasn't considered to be as effective. So, we'll keep looking at those types of things and seeing where we can make adjustments so we're better serving our students.
All right. Let's talk quickly about traffic. The Park City Council, and we'll be talking to Liza Simpson about that coming up. But the cost for building the kind of the interior roads within the Kearns campus, the school district is relying on Park City Municipal to do that, Todd?
I wasn't at the meeting yesterday, so
I was not there.
We had another board, I think another couple of board representatives there, not Tanya or me. But what I will say is that we haven't made a decision that we want to build frontage roads within the campus. It's just an idea that's being considered. And it's pretty clear to the board that when we take today 20% of our student population and move it out to the Ecker Hill campus, we've greatly reduced the traffic impact on Kearns. So, that being said, this wasn't our biggest fish to fry in this round of decisions. But we do look forward to, as we have a ironed out plan in the next week or two, then sitting down with our partners at the city and figuring out what the ideal solution would be with an open mind.
All right. So only one more meeting scheduled for Tuesday.
Correct.
To kind of figure all of this out. So
yeah.
Are you spending a day on that as well? I think it starts at 4 o'clock.
So it'll be a regular session. It'll start at 4 o'clock. And the board will receive some more information. They asked some good questions this week, and we'll hopefully have good responses to those questions. And then public comment will begin at 5:30. And so we invite the public to come and respond to what they've heard from the retreat and any other concerns or ideas that they feel the board should take into consideration. So that time will be available at 5:30 on Tuesday. Then the board will need to wrap up and pull the thoughts together so that we can begin putting a financing plan together.
And you'll spend that next week between the 11th and the 18th?
Yeah, we'll need to iron out a number because by the 18th, if indeed we will go to bond, we need a resolution passed. Otherwise, we will miss the November 3rd election.
All right. Do you feel like you still have a lot of balls in the air? I mean, as the person who's responsible for coming up with it?
As Tanya mentioned before, most of what the master planning recommendation had in it is acceptable, if that's the right word to say. And I think there's just a few things that are ironed out. Some of them are big. You know, does Dozier move? And I think it might. And what do we do about a field house? So we're down to just a couple of pieces. They're big, but a couple of pieces.
Sure. And just most of the meeting is going to be about master planning, and we're really intentionally making it so there's some information and discussion going on at 4 o'clock. So people that want to come at 5:30 to speak, we encourage them to come and speak at four or listen at four because their questions might be answered. And additionally, there'll be discussion after public comment. So, you know, I feel like there's a very good opportunity for the public to be heard for whatever reason they want to come and talk to us. And also, If the public has any concerns, we've been asked about noise level, lights, all kinds of stuff. And there's an amazing amount of information on board docs. You can look at the VCBO report. You can also look at the report that the Master Planning Committee put together because there's all kinds of there's the light and the noise.
There were several studies done through our VCBO contract, and the full report of those studies are in the appendices to the Master Planning Recommendation. So when you go out into board docs, you'll see a link that will take you out to that information.
Okay. Tanya Knauer and Phil Kaplan and Todd Halbert, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks,
Leslie.
Thank you, Leslie.
It's 8:37 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW. In the studio with me, Park City Council Member Liza Simpson. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Well, let's talk first, kind of follow up with regard to the school issue, the city council receiving a presentation on the school master plan. It seemed like we had the mayor on one hand and then the council on the other hand. The mayor actually just really displeased with, I think, what he was hearing. I mean, this isn't the first you have heard about this, no?
No, not at all. And, you know, those of us who have been really following the process understand just how much hard work the Master Planning Committee and the school board and the school district staff, including the superintendent, have put into this. We understand that there have been many permutations, many things looked at. And I know from my experience on council that sometimes when you go through that kind of a process and you commit to kind of looking at all of the alternatives, there are always going to be people who don't like alternative A, don't like alternative B, don't like alternative C, which, you know, doesn't mean they shouldn't be considered and discussed.
Yeah. Well, until 15 minutes ago, I was thinking that Mayor was going to be here to kind of talk about his concerns. And since I wasn't prepared for you to be here, I'd like to just kind of follow up with maybe you can speak a little bit in terms of the mayor. I mean, his concern is that we're busing kids out of town, which he was saying that does not create a small town feel.
Well, you know, I'll do my best. And Jack, I apologize if I get this wrong because it's never good to speak for someone else on their opinions. But I think Jack's concern stems from a discussion that we've been having for quite a while about what is a complete community. And that's part of the reason why we're so focused on affordable housing now. And, you know, I think it's clear to everyone who has kids in the district that, you know, we've had a middle school, Ecker Hill, where all the kids in the district have been going now for, I don't know, 10 years. So, you know, Jack may see this as an exacerbation of that, and he may have seen that as a problem. But I think it's less specific to the master plan as much as it is more to his concern that we be a complete community. And I remember when the discussions were happening about possibly moving the entire campus, you know, that we all felt pretty strongly that it was important to continue to have schools in the city. And frankly, I think people were most committed to making sure that the high school stayed in the community. It's a little hard for me to speak to Jack's concerns, but I know that that's one of the pieces that he was basing his comments on was the complete community idea, which we all agree with. But I think it's important to recognize that the education professionals know what's best for kids from a learning standpoint and when the best time is to bring disparate grades together and different, you know, kids from different schools into one school so that they have a chance to integrate and form new friendships before they move on to, I mean, part of it is about the social education, if you will. And yeah. I'm not a education professional, so I'm probably using exactly the wrong term.
Still, I mean, it's the case that 75% of the students in the district live beyond the White Barn. So
right,
that
and I
makes
think,
sense to put schools where the kids are, no?
Right, and I think that the Master Plan Planning Committee and the school board have done a really good job of looking at their district as a whole. I think that's where you know, sometimes there's a little rub between those of us who represent the city and the school board that represents the entire district. And I think what they're doing makes sense.
Let's talk a little bit about just the issue of Kearns Boulevard. Apparently some interlocal agreements just we're starting to talk about so that Park City would help pay for some kind of a frontage road to get the traffic off of Kearns Boulevard and put it into the school area.
Yeah, those conversations have been ongoing at a staff level, and they finally, you know, have burbled up to both the school board level and the city council level. And basically, I'm very excited to partner with the school district and look at a number of things. I clarified last night, I wanted to clarify for my own understanding, but also for the public, that what we're hoping to do with this interlocal agreement is include some language in the bond resolution that would allow the school district to use some of the bond funds if they should choose to do so to address traffic and congestion and parking. And what that means in the future and how we figure it out, whether that's a frontage road, whether it's an emergency exit onto Lucky John, whether it's a buses only entrance and exit onto Lucky John, whether it's partnering in structured parking, you know, that could then be used for special events on the weekend. All of those are just a sum of the possible permutations, but it was very important to me that everybody understand that the bond language that we're asking them to consider would not mean that the school district has to do it. It would mean that the school district could choose to do so. For example, should a reduction in curb cuts be and left-hand turns, which we all know are problematic, should that be the solution that everybody agrees to be a frontage road? And I don't know, I'm totally throwing out numbers here. Let's just say that's a $4 million road. If the school district wanted to contribute $1 million towards the construction of that, the language that we're talking about would allow them to do it. Again, it would not require them to do so. So I'm actually very excited that we are having these conversations and that we're able to sort of partner to solve what I view as a community problem, not a city problem, not a school district problem, but a community problem.
Yeah. Mayor does have a problem, though, with any kind of traffic coming out onto Lucky John. I don't know if that's because that's his neighborhood or if he just thinks it's the wrong thing to do. But we've got the city has an easement that runs along that road out past the North 40 that would kind of pull back into Lucky John, where Lucky John and Meadows Drive, I believe, comes together. Is that what we're talking about? Perhaps providing another egress there as well?
My understanding, and it's not completely clear because, of course, we haven't really done the hard work to study this. I think you're right. I think that's exactly where a city easement is. I remember finding out about that years ago when Joe Kernan was suggesting that we should put a tunnel under Deercrest as another entrance into town. And I was astonished that easement existed because I believe it predates the development. And so, you know, it's one of those things where somebody was looking at a blank slate and said, well, here, you know, we might want to put a road here someday. And I was pretty astonished that it existed. But I think if I understand correctly from Diane Foster, the city manager, it may be that there are other locations where easements exist that might be more appropriate and more useful to the school district in their traffic planning.
All right, let's move on. The what's next Park City, any new information here?
Well, one of the things I'm most excited about with this is that we felt like the model that we used of doing a presentation and then following that up with small group discussions was very well received. We had good public turnout, and Phyllis Robinson and Ann Ober have come to us with some of the next steps. The thing I'm most excited about is subjects that that the public told us they would like to hear about, that we might maybe set up doing these type of forums maybe on a quarterly basis, you know, where we use the same model that we did for growth. Some of those topics include, no surprise, transportation, but also planning 101, a follow-up on the growth discussion after Envision Utah has had a chance to really sift through all of their survey responses. Another subject was affordable housing. And then one that I'm awfully excited about, which is Founding Voices Forum, that would gather together some of the longtime residents in town, both people like Gary Kimball, you know, who's been here his entire life, but also that large group of people who moved here in the late 60s and early 70s and really spent a lot of time shaping our town. And the reason I'm most excited about that is that I think we have a lot of new people who've moved to town who are great new residents, and we love having them. But I don't think sometimes that they understand all the hard work that we all put in to make it the place that it is. I think they're absolutely willing to help. I just think they don't understand how intentional that work was, and that we need them as part of the fabric. And I think that's a great way to do it, by listening to, well, people like yourself who've lived here for years and years and, you know, helped shape things and change things.
Well, that was back in the days when Park City ended at the city golf course.
Right. And the buses only ran in the winter and the summer and not in the spring and in the fall.
Yep. Bob Wills Plaza, the city council talked about naming the plaza below us here at KPCW after Bob Wills. Is that going to happen?
It's going to happen. Yeah. Patty and I were both getting ready to burst into tears. We laughed afterwards that we were both so determined not to do it. It's hard to think of a community member, even though in this community we are rich with community members who help and serve. But it's hard to think of a person who served and helped as many as Bob did, between his professional work at Deer Valley and his personal work founding what was then called ICHTHOS and became the Mountainlands Community Housing Trust, to his work with Peace House. Bob truly was one of those people who believed he was blessed and that it was his job to help others and share those blessings with other people. So we were absolutely unanimous that this is entirely appropriate. The location is funny because I don't know if you know this, but Bob's route, because of what he did for a living and his lifestyle, Patty said, was, you know, his route in doing his errands was to come and park in the parking lot at the post office and or here on Sweet Alley and go into the post office and get his mail and then go up to City Hall to do whatever it is he needed to do that day. So it's a perfect location.
So when does that happen?
We're working on language with Patty, Bob's widow, and the staff will come back with a resolution actually doing the naming and figuring out what the plaque is going to say.
Okay.
So soon.
The discussion on 569 Park Avenue went on forever. We don't have a forever to talk about it. But basically, the owner has not even asked for a demolition permit. But we're talking about whether or not the home can be demolished. So did the council come to a decision about that? Or?
Well, and just to be strictly clear, yes, the owners have not applied for a demolition permit. However, they have put in a pre-application notice that is kind of the direction that they were going. We don't have time to talk about all the convolutions, but the bottom line is that last night we directed staff to come back with an ordinance and associated land management changes that would address what do we do about houses that maybe are substantially or not so substantially historic, don't actually fit the form completely. But what makes them not fit the form completely is something that could be removed, could be fixed to restore it to its full historic integrity. And because we've directed staff to do that, we are currently under what is called a pending ordinance doctrine, which means that there is an ordinance pending, so no demolitions can go forward until the language of that ordinance has been drafted and heard before City Council and either voted in approval or voted down. And so essentially, it's a stay on any demolitions in the historic district so we can sit down and sort this out and figure out what to do. I mean, we had this conversation to a certain degree when we did our historic district guidelines in 2008, 2009, and we did our historic sites inventory and our list. And you probably remember we had quite a bit of discussion about houses that currently on our list we deem as significant. They're not landmark status. They're not in perfect shape. They don't meet all of the integrity of a landmark home. But because of our community deems them important, we have a subset of that list that's deemed significant. So one of the things we'll probably be looking at is, do we create a third tier that are houses that could be fixed, could be restored, but currently don't fit the form? So I don't know how that conversation's going to go. Staff will be coming back with it.
Yeah. So when does the clock expire, though, with regard to that pending ordinance?
I don't know that there's an expiration date, but we're certainly not going to sit on our hands and wait to have that conversation. I would expect, and Diane Foster will probably kill me for saying this because staff's pretty busy already, but I would expect that we'll see that language in the next 60 days or so.
Okay, so it's not like a six-month TZO on this.
It's subtly different from a TZO, but you'd have to get the city attorney in to explain those differences.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Just want to thank everybody for showing up. We had a great group from the youth theater come in. That was fun, and that's all I've got.
Okay. Liza, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Leslie.
It's Park City Council Member Liza Simpson. KPCW News Time now, 8:52. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Deer Valley Resorts, the Brass Tag, created the winning cocktail for this summer's cocktail contest. In the studio with me, I have Deer Valley's food and beverage director, Jody Rogers, along with the drinks creator, Josh Hockman, and the director of the Park City Restaurant Association, Ginger Rees. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So you knew that you won, Josh, right?
I didn't know I was informed, yes.
Okay, well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And you've got a gift certificate, but let's hold off on
okay.
that. Let's kind of build up here. So you created what's called, you call the Evangeline?
That's right. That's
All right.
The Evangeline. The Evangeline is a mining claim that's on Deer Valley property. And at the Brass Tag, we name all of our signature cocktails after those mining claim names. And we also do the same at the resort with the ski runs and the chairlifts.
All right. So you won, you know, like 3,200, almost 3,300 votes out of the 10,500. So tell us what's in the Evangeline that people love so much.
Yeah, we got a lot of good support from everyone that was in and tried it. What we use as our base spirit in there is a local gin out of Salt Lake City. That's the Beehive Distillery. We also use local honey from Provo, the Clifford Farm honey, that we make a simple syrup out of and infuse it with some fresh basil. We also use a cassis shrub or a cassis drinking vinegar, which is a blackcurrant flavor. And then we top it with some rose-infused sparkling pink lemonade.
All right, so not many of us have the vinegar and basil-infused honey.
Yeah,
rose lemonade.
Yeah, kind of thinking outside the box on that one.
Yeah, so, I mean, is that something that the Brass Tag just keeps in stock then?
Right, we get special orders in for that. All of Deer Valley probably uses most of those ingredients, so for us it's not new, but it is available around because they are local. People can source those.
Yeah, so an interesting combination. I mean, what inspired you?
Really, I wanted to keep it, summer cocktail contest. I wanted to keep it, light, refreshing, but also have some really interesting flavors in there with the herbal back note, if you will, on the drink, not just a sweet cocktail like you might be used to in the summertime, but dial in that herbal note.
Okay. So Deer Valley does pretty well at these cocktail contests.
Bonnie in the past has won quite a few of them,
yeah.
Actually. She also had a great cocktail this year, too, the Zanarita. Kind of healthy, but yeah, she's done very well. So she set the precedence, and it looks like Josh is able to continue that. So we're very lucky to have great stuff.
Yeah, well, congratulations. So does the Evangeline then just get served at the Brass Tag, or
correct.
Do you won't bring it up to McHenry's? Or
we like each bartender to be able to be creative and do their own kind of cocktails and really be proud of what they do. So, and I think that's important. We do the same with the chefs. Everyone has to have their own creativity. So that way people can actually dine around and enjoy each bartender's or chef's cuisine.
Okay, so Ginger, I mean, as kind of the organizer of the event.
Yes, so I get the pleasure. It's actually hard, cold cash.
Yeah, it is.
Josh is the fabulous winner of $200.
Thank you very much.
So there you go,
much
sir. Don't spend it all in one place.
Okay.
Well, I should have waited to take the picture because that's the money shot.
Yeah.
Literally.
Literally.
So What did voters have to say about it? Were there comments online about?
I think all the comments that I saw. I think, you know, it's just a way to get people out. It's a fun way to kind of try and drive people into all of our amazing restaurants that we have out there. It's a fun event for the local mixologists to get behind and do something different on their spring cocktail menus or summer cocktail menus. So the feedback overall has been very positive. We had a ton of traffic to our website, which is great for everybody, showcasing all the restaurants that we have in our community. So overall, it was a successful event for us.
Yeah. So you had how many competing?
We had 16 different restaurants in the area competing.
Yeah. Can you talk about, I mean, how close was number two?
Well, number two was Sushi Blue, and they came in with 2,970 votes. And then the third place person was the High West Distillery, coming in with 1,357.
Okay. So those top two were actually, yeah.
They were very close.
Yeah.
Hmm. So, but I encourage everybody to get out. I think all the restaurants are still serving all these cocktails, so you can still get out and sample them if you didn't have the opportunity to do so. And all of the cocktails and their recipes are featured on our website, which is parkcityrestaurants.com, including Josh's. So you can try to make them at home if you want to as well.
So this is the summer cocktail contest. Mm-hmm. Are you going to do another one then for the winter, or how does it work?
No, right. The last 2 years we've only focused on summer. For the restaurants, winter is busy enough.
And I think the point is, you know, such a great time of year for people to come up and try those cocktails. Mm-hmm. So it's a really good incentive for those that aren't working like we are to come and really enjoy the restaurants and know that we still have cocktails. That mm-hmm. was the original thought.
Right. So. Just to reemphasize that you can get a refreshing drink.
So, I mean, as you're bartending then, you're going to be pushing the Evangeline then? Is that kind
of, yeah? Absolutely, yeah. The word's actually gotten out that we won this contest, and last night I think we peddled about a dozen or 15 of them. So, yeah, we're going to keep that going and highlight that for the next year, so I'd be proud of our winnings.
Okay. All right, anything else you wanted to mention?
Nope.
Okay, congratulations again, Josh.
Thank you very much.
Thanks
for coming in.